2 years ago, a relatively unknown Christian man who'd never written a book in his life wrote one, and within a few months it skyrocketed to the top of the bestseller list in Christian circles. And it wasn't long till the name of Keith Miller became a household word across our country and overseas as well, for his book, The Taste of New Wine, and then for his second book, The Second Touch. And why was this? I think there's something very unique that caused this to happen. I think the reason is that Keith is real, and he is honest. His first book that he wrote is so tremendously honest, and he is so refreshing in it. And sometimes, to those of us who are so pious, so startlingly refreshing and honest, that all of us who have spent all of our lives since childhood practicing how to be convincing phonies, and who have tried to become masters at the art of fakery, though we wouldn't admit it, I think this book came to those of us who read it as a breath of fresh, unpolluted air. I don't know about you, but I feel like from the time we're little girls, we're taught to fake it. A little girl gets stepped on in the supermarket. A fat lady steps on her hand, and she screams. And her mother doesn't say, "Oh, honey, let me see your hand." She says, "What do people think?" And you go to a party, and you're... Mom says, "Well, just pretend, just smile, pretend like you're having a good time." And so we're taught from the time we're little to wear the mask and to pretend. And so, of course, this does a great deal to put masks on our faces and on our lives. And as Keith Miller says in his book, you know, you wear one mask with this crowd, and then you have to wear another mask with another crowd, and then you wear another mask when you're at home, and pretty soon you get spiritual hernias on your soul from carrying these heavy masks, because they do get heavier and heavier and heavier. And I'm sure there's some of you here tonight who are tired of carrying the mask. You're tired of trying to be Miss Sparkly Christian. And though you always pretend to have all the answers, you know deep in your heart, it's just not true. And though you may bask in the adulation of someone who says, "Oh, listen, she is a terrific Christian. She is really great." Deep in your heart, you know it's not really true. And you wonder if they'll ever find you with the mask slipped. Those of us who are married, I think, probably all came to an awakening time when we realized our husbands had seen us with the mask down. And we thought, boy, it was all over now. And the amazing thing was to find out that he still loved us with the mask off even more. On a personal level, this matter of honesty became more real to me. Just recently, through our Christian Women's Club in Oklahoma City, we've had several women who are brand new Christians give their testimony. And there was something very, very refreshing and very, something that rang very true. And I noticed that after each of these girls gave their testimony, we had many come to know the Savior. And the one keynote of all of their testimonies is that these were girls who had been faking it like the rest of us. They had been faking it socially, and they were the up-and-coming social climbers, you might say. And they were so tired of faking it, and they were so tired of carrying these various heavy masks and wearing their little Novocaine smiles, but they were willing, even though it was very costly, to share what life was like behind this gay Halloween mask, and to share what life was like before in all of its phoniness, and then to be freed from phoniness of Jesus Christ. And the impact of their lives was tremendous. And they hadn't learned from we older Christian buddies yet that you can fake it spiritually, too, see. They were so excited to be delivered from the phoniness of the world. And they hadn't been around the rest of us long enough to know that you can just transfer phoniness to the spiritual life. Well, then I was asked to give to speak at a couple of Christian women's clubs in other towns. And I was a little disturbed by this because, you see, my testimony is very sweet and simple. I've always been a good girl. And I grew up in a Christian home. I've never done anything bad, sort of thing, you know. And they make it very specific. They don't want to talk. They want a testimony. And so I began to think about this, and I thought, what in the world will I say if I can't preach a little, you know? I mean, if I can't tell somebody else's story, really, my testimony, when you accept the Lord at 6 and a half, you know, what life do you have to tell about before? And so as I thought this over, realizing, you know, I wasn't on tranquilizers, and I wasn't an alcoholic, and, you know, I hadn't been delivered from a broken home, I really just didn't have anything horribly bad to say. And I was sharing with my friend, a friend of mine in Oklahoma City, who is one of my new honest friends that I am so enjoying. And I said, well, I've thought about presenting it this way, and I've thought about, you know, this. And she said, Irm, I like that second one, but, you know, you tell it very well, but you really didn't tell me anything about yourself. And I was couching my testimony in the prodigal son story, not identifying with the prodigal, but identifying with the self-righteous elder brother. And I said wee little, you know, in saying, you know, I was just like him. When I got peace, he said, you didn't tell me anything about yourself. You didn't let me know you. So I went home and rewrote it. And I guess it's the first time in my life that I really tried to be as honest with God and with myself and with others as I could be. Have you ever tried to write down on paper what you hardly will admit to yourself? And then have you ever tried to say it out loud? And I found myself writing things I hadn't even shared with my husband about me. Not that he didn't know them. But I realized, as honest as I thought I was with him, that I was writing things down on that paper about what it's like to be the self-righteous older brother, to have always done everything right, and to have looked down your long spiritual nose at everyone who did everything wrong, according to your standards. And so, of course, this was very difficult. Things that I found that I knew to be very true, but I sure was hoping others hadn't discovered them yet. And yet, in all honesty, I had to admit that probably they knew it a long time before I was willing to admit it. That probably I was the only one that was being fooled. But you know, once the cat was out of the bag, and once I had said out loud with my own voice what a rotten mess I was, you know, I felt so relieved and so free. And so I'm not coming to you tonight trying to speak to you as one who is an authority or an example, either one. I am only beginning in this walk of honesty. And I can't even say that I'm free of all the masks. Because, you know, this is the thing that's been natural all my life is to wear the mask. And I find I put them back on without ever knowing it, because it's very natural to be what I'm not. And it's very hard not to put the mask on, because I find that there are times when I do care terribly about what people think. I do care what their impression is. And so I find it, you know, every once in a while that I'm trying to flip the mask back on and wear the Novocaine smile again so I can make what I think is a good impression. But I would like to talk to you about it because I do think, though it is not the easiest way, it is by all means the best way. And easiest in the long run. It's not easy on yourself, but it's far easier than trying to carry all the mass. And it costs you. It costs your pride. It costs your precious self-esteem, your self-respect. It costs the self to be willing to let even one other person in behind the facade. And it would be difficult for you girls in this training situation because you are supposed to be very hungry, spiritual girls who have come for training. You're living in situations where you're each watching each other. And it will be hard for you with each other, and it will be hard for you before the fellows that you're trying to impress, before Max, Sandra, Margaret. It'll be hard for you to not wear the mask. And to be honest, it'll be costly, but worth it. And so that's how we came to this topic tonight. I thought, first of all, it might be well if we defined what it was so that we all know we're talking on the same level. Honesty, according to the dictionary, is being what it seems, something genuine, frank and open, being truthful, trustworthy, sincere, straightforward. And I thought another definition that we might ought to get down is what I feel is the opposite of honesty, and probably what each of us are to some degree, though we would not like to admit it, and probably we have labeled other people as a hypocrite, but would not like to be classed as one. But I think when we think in terms of wearing a mask and not being honest, it equals being a hypocrite. And hypocrisy, according to the dictionary, is acting a part, pretending to be what one is not, or to feel what one does not feel, especially pretending a virtue, a pretense of a virtue. A hypocrite is one who pretends to be better than he is. Proverbs 26:23 in the Living Psalm says, pretty words may hide a wicked heart, just as a pretty glaze covers a common clay pot. And so many of us feel like common clay pots, and we feel nobody wants a common clay pot, and so we put a glaze on and we wear the mask. Bruce Larson, in his book Dare to Live Now, has a chapter called Honesty is the Only Policy. And I would like to just quote a bit from that for you. It's a very good book, incidentally. Dare to Live Now by Bruce Larson. He starts out, God is not shocked by our sin. There isn't any sin that any of us has committed or is now practicing that Jesus Christ did not deal with realistically in his life and sacrificially on the cross. Jesus associated with call girls, alcoholics, fiddlers. He didn't condone what they did, nor did he leave them as he found them. But the record indicates that they enjoyed his company. Are you associated today with any call girls or alcoholics or fiddlers or et cetera, who thoroughly enjoy your company? However, it is recorded in the fifth chapter of the book of Acts that two very fine people, Ananias and Sapphira, dropped dead in our Lord's first church. They weren't drunk. And as far as we know, he wasn't stepping out on us. They went to prayer meetings. They were more than tithers. But they were pretending to be something that wasn't true before God and his people. They didn't have to give a cent of the land that they sold to the church. But they pretended to give it all when actually they had only given half. Now, God didn't kill them. The spiritual laws are such that when we are hypocrites, we cut ourselves off from the life God wants to give. Now, how accurate a picture do you think Ananias and Sapphira give us of our own lives today? The goody-goodies who go to church, who do all the right things, but who hide behind the mask of pretense. And their sin, which God felt was worthy of death, was that they lied. They pretended. They pretended to give all that they had, which just wasn't true. You know, the lie that we live is probably only a lie to us, because I think we only fool ourselves. I'm sure everybody else who studies this closely knows us better than we like to think they do. Now, I wonder tonight, are you willing for anyone to really know you? Do you dare find out who you really are? And do you dare let anyone else know you? Let me just say, for those of you who aren't married, that the only way to a happy marriage is to be known by one another, to know and be known. And the more you try and hide behind a mask in a marriage, as in any relationship, the further apart you're going to grow. Galatians 6:3, Linda, I think you have that, if you can read it loudly. If we think we are something who are nothing, we only deceive ourselves. I can remember many years ago that I was associated with a girl who meant a great deal to me, and she shared her life with me and loved me enough to be honest with me. And she would say, you know, Irm, I've noticed so-and-so, and then she'd tell me something that made me less than my best for Christ's sake and my witness to others. And, it crushed, pierced like a knife. And I'd get alone with the Lord, and I'd finally say, Lord, I really was aware of that, way down deep. I didn't want to admit it because I thought, you know, kind of if I didn't admit it, it really wasn't true. And I probably thought God didn't notice it. Another thing that got through to me was then I'd think, Lord, if Addie noticed it, surely the whole world knows that I'm this way. And of course, the thing that should have gotten to me was that God knew it all along. But you see, we are so phony, I am so phony, that I care terribly that nobody else knows how phony I am. And of course, God knows it all the time. And the amazing thing is that he loves us just that way. He loved us in the first place, knowing how phony we were. My husband met a missionary couple several years ago, and he said, well, tell me how you all met. And they kind of blushed and said, well, we don't usually tell people. And he said, well, you can tell me. I've just met you. I don't know you. And they said, we met in a bar before we knew Christ. And do you know something? We missed the fellowship of the bar. You know, the bar is probably the best counterfeit there is today to the fellowship that Christ intends that his church has, we being his church. It's an imitation, true. But it's like what the church ought to be, only it has liquor at its center instead of grace, and it has escape instead of reality. But let me show you what a bar is like. A bar is a permissive, accepting, inclusive fellowship, unshockable, Democrat. You can tell people secrets there, and nobody repeats them, and nobody even wants to. Nobody says squeal. And there's sympathy and there's understanding. Now, how about this group right here? Does that fit you? You who know each other quite well, most of you by now. You who live in apartments together. Between those three or four or five, however many there are in each apartment, is there this kind of an atmosphere? A permissive, accepting, inclusive fellowship, unshockable? Can people come to you open-heartedly to tell you their deepest, shocking secrets and know that you don't even care to repeat them? The bar flourishes not because people are alcoholics, but because God put down in the human heart the desire for each one of us to know and be known, to love and be loved. These are two very basic human things that God put in the heart of each one of us. And you know, unfortunately, girls, the church, and again I say when I speak of the church, I don't mean a building, I mean those of us who know Jesus Christ, rarely offers this to a non-Christian who is lonely and troubled and seeking help. And so they turn to the counterfeit at the price of a few beers. Now it's interesting in the Old Testament, when David was running from Saul, do you know where he found comfort? Remember, he feigned insanity and was flossing at the mouth in order to get away from this dreadful situation. Do you know where he found comfort? In the camp of the enemy with the non-Christians. You know what happens when someone goes down the tube? We say, I knew it all the time. I could have told you that. They weren't like us. They weren't one of our groups. They weren't sincere, etc. ad nauseum. And so that one who truly wants to follow Christ, but perhaps is dared to bear his mask, and we have thrown up our hands in holy horror and dismissed them from our group, where do they go? They go back to the camp of the enemy, and then we say, I could have told you so, I knew it all the time. This is another substitute, you see, for what Christ meant that we as the church should be to one another. We should be unshockable and democratic and permissive and filled with the real Spirit of God. A fellowship where people can come in and say, boy, I am stunk. I've had it. I'm beat. But what do we say to one another? Well, how's it going? Great, just great. Everything's fine. Isn't the Lord wonderful? And down deep, we may be crying, longing for someone that we could say, I have had one hell of a day. It's very interesting that much of the indifferent and irreligious part of our society is living a fairly honest life, as opposed to the Christians who are so adept at carrying the mask. They are lost, lonely, rebellious, and confused, and yet, you know, they often have more genuine concern for one another than we Christians have. They don't have the soul-stifling pretense that we so often carry about us. Sure, they cheat on their income tax, but then they go and laugh about it openly on the golf course. Or they get drunk and in front of a whole club of their friends. They tell their marital problems to the hairdresser. They talk honestly with the bartender. Tell their deepest problems to a psychiatrist. Discuss all manner of things in the locker room. They don't have the answer, you see, for these problems, but they are more open and more transparent than most of us are as Christians with one another. We have built up walls about us, and we hold each other off at arm's length. We don't want you to get down and see what's really inside here. We think somehow that being a false thing is better than being the real thing. So, Mike, that was all under introduction and point number one. Now, point number two is, how important is all this to God? There are certainly many scriptural examples. I just chose a few. Ananias and Sapphira, the story I mentioned, is in Acts 5. This is certainly one of them. And then there's a story in the Old Testament about Saul in 1 Samuel 15. Goes through most of the chapter. The gist of what I'm going to tell you is in 13 to 23, but it goes through most of it. God, through the prophet Samuel, had given a message that Saul was to go out and with his army and was to do so-and-so in capturing these people. They were not to bring back any alive, no animals, no people, etc., etc. They weren't to take spoil. They were just, you know, be done with the whole affair. And so Saul came back, and God had spoken to the prophet Samuel and said, I am grieved over this man, Saul. He didn't do what I asked him to at all. So Saul came jollying down the road, you know, and I imagine he was whistling a happy tune. And Samuel met him. And he said, well, God bless you, Samuel. I did what God told me to. Had a good day, you know. And Samuel said, oh, is that right? Don't I hear the bleating of sheep behind me? What's all this about? And don't I see a few people? And Saul said, oh, well, we brought the king back. I forget what excuse he used there. And we brought the animals back to sacrifice, I think was the excuse he used. And then he said, the people wanted to do it. And Samuel ends up this little conversation with him saying, Saul, that has cost you the kingdom. That's all. God says, Sam, Saul, if all of this is important to me as just being honest, just doing my will, being obedient, he said, because you have disobeyed me, it has cost you the kingdom. And that's quite a price, isn't it? See, if he had even come back and been honest, but he wasn't. He came back and lied to God's prophet and to God himself. Then there's the example in Luke 13 of when Jesus cursed the fig tree. Have you ever wondered about that? I always felt so sorry for the fig tree. And I thought, that really wasn't fair. You know, he just walked up to a fig tree and cursed it. And I really just didn't understand that. And then I read where when a fig tree bears leaves, that this is the final stage, you might say, the sign that fruit is coming. It's a sign of fruitfulness. And you know, it says in the scriptures that it wasn't the season for fruit, for figs. And I really thought the Lord had done wrong. If it wasn't the season for figs, why did he curse the fig tree? But then it says in there that the fig tree was leafy, bore the leaves, you see. And so it was wearing the garment of fruitfulness. It was pretending to be something it wasn't. This is why Jesus cursed it. And he likewise hates the pretense in us, the wearing of the mask, the dressing up in the costume that makes us look better. And there comes a day when, as he did the fig tree, it said it withered, that all of the masks we wear are stripped away. You can't carry them all the time. And then Christ on example. Did you ever think of how the disciples would have known about his wilderness temptation? To write about it? Those horrible days in the sense of being tempted of Satan in the desert, how did they know about that? If Christ had not been honest with them to tell them. And then 1 John 1:5 says that God is light. And you know, when light shines on anything, it shows it like it is. And if God is light, then it's important for us to realize when we stand in that light, it shows us like it is. It shows us like we are. What are some reasons we're not honest? I think there are about six of them, probably many more, but here are a few of them. One is that we fear the fear of being known. We spend so much time dressing up for the masquerade to impress people and to be well thought of and to be accepted. But the prospect of unmasking is not a pleasant one to us. And few of us like ourselves like we are, and we're sure nobody else would if they really knew us like we are. And we're afraid that we'll look foolish or ignorant. We're fearful that if others see us as we are, they won't like us, and so we try to be somebody else. It's one of the kindest things my husband ever did for me was when he first got to know me, long before we were married. He used to say to me, "Earn, just be yourself. Can't be anybody else as good as you can be yourself." And I didn't know it, but I was trying to be, you know, Miss Dynamic Christian, Miss Sparkly Navigator, Miss Perfect Everything. And I don't know what all that's supposed to be, but I was trying to be that. And I was trying to fit into somebody's mold, you know. And he again and again would say to me, "Earn, just relax. Just be yourself." But we don't like to be known. And then the second thing is we're fearful of being exploited, talked about, gossip. And you know the awful truth is that when, among so many of us, it's true that if someone is honest with us and shares their heart with us, drops the mask, the next thing they know is they hear it from several quarters because their trusted Christian friends have shared it. And most of the time we share it in a very pious manner. We say, "Well, now, I really only share this with you, Margaret, so we can pray about it. One of our dear friends is real," you know, and then we go on with glee. We can hardly wait to get there to share it. And we make it a worse sin by saying, "I only tell you this so we can pray about it." Talk about gossip. And you know, the awful truth is that when, among so many of us, it's true that if someone is honest with us and shares their heart with us, drops the mask, the next thing they know is they hear it from several quarters because their trusted Christian friends have shared it. And most of the time we share it in a very pious manner. We say, "Well, now, I really only share this with you, Margaret, so we can pray about it. One of our dear friends is real," you know, and then we go on with glee. We can hardly wait to get there to share it. And we make it a worse sin by saying, "I only tell you this so we can pray about it." And you know, we really don't gossip nearly as much about our non-Christian friends as we do our Christian friends. The third one is the fear of disappointment. Perhaps you've tried at one time or another to open up and you've revealed some deep need to someone and they've said to you something like this, "Oh, well, I know you. That's not your problem, not you." And they refuse to let you have a problem. A friend of ours was had a nervous breakdown, a mental breakdown, and when she was just getting over it, another friend called and said, "How are you feeling today? I bet you're feeling much better." You know, she'd just come off the hospital. She said, "Well, no, as a matter of fact, I'm not." And the Christian friend on the other end was so frustrated, and she said, "Oh, well, I'm sure you are. I just know you're feeling better. You must be." And our little friend said, "Well, really, I'm not." But you know, the friend wouldn't let her feel badly because, you see, it made her feel badly. And so she kept saying, "Oh, I'm just sure you're feeling better." She wouldn't let her have the problem. And this is what we so often do. Or when somebody opens up to us before they can even finish speaking, we have shot back at them chapter, verse, pat answer with reference before and after, before we've heard them out. And after a few pat answers, you know, they're not going to be opening up to you again. And so they have a fear of disappointment. Or maybe they have, under this matter of disappointment, maybe with you personally or in a group situation, they've bared their problem and have very quickly had the subject changed because it got too close to the group's own unresolved problems or your own personal unresolved problems, and so you skirted the issue. Change subject. And you know it's going to be a long time before they'll be honest with you again. Another fear is the fear of change, and of course all of us resist change. The fear of change. Even though we know it'd be a change for the better, we resist change. We like our comfortable mold we've settled into. Similar to the fear of change is this fear of failure. You know, the fear that, well, if I take this new step, I may fall flat on my face. in plain view of others. And this will be even more embarrassing. We rationalize and say, well, you know, knowing myself as I do and knowing my inability to really stick to a resolution, and I, you know, I don't want to do this, and if I can't do it all the way, and so, you know, it's just better for me not to. And so we rationalize because we have a fear of failing before others. And then the fear of sacrifice. And you know, when you become deeply involved, honestly, with other people, sharing your problems and hearing theirs, it puts on you your responsibility. And we don't want to make that sacrifice, because to be deeply involved with others costs you. And we don't want that responsibility. Proverbs 16:2 in the Living Psalms brings out another thought. Says we can prove, we can always prove that we are right. But is the Lord convinced? And I think there is in each of us this tremendous desire, stronger in some than in others, to be right. We can't admit we're wrong. And of course, to admit that we are not what we have pretended to be is a great admission. We want always to be right. It's hard to say we're wrong. You know, if I'm sure that among these girls here tonight, if Margaret or Sandy had asked you, well, how would you like to have a discussion group, and they named off many subjects, you know, like Bible doctrines, yeah, great, sure, we'd love that. How about one on morality? Oh, great, we need that, you know, like that. How about just kicking around doing it, like, sure, that sounds great. How about a group on prayer? Oh, yeah, I'd like that. How about a group on where we just share the growing edge of our lives daily in an honest fashion? Probably wouldn't be any takers for that group. But those who have tried this have come to a new freedom in their life and walk with Christ. I think probably this is harder for girls than for fellows. Harder for us to be honest with one another, share our hearts. Well, what are some of the values of this kind of a life? I have four values. I'm sure there are many more. The first one is that this kind of honesty is essential to real, valid Christian growth. You know, in each of our lives, God keeps showing us that at heart we're a phony. A sinner might be another term for it, but a phony. And you know, maybe before you knew the Lord, you told out-and-out social lies, you know. And now you certainly are done with that. You don't do that anymore. But you're very subtle now. You can lie with the truth. You can present true facts. A truth based on facts, but it projects an image of you which gives a totally false picture. And God, you know, is great at puncturing those lies like a balloon. And it's costly, but it's very therapeutic and very liberating when we let him do this. So it's essential to our Christian growth that we're honest with God, that we're honest with ourselves, and that we're honest with others. And a second thing is that honesty is God's way for a family of Christians to become a Christian family. Now, this could be in the context, of course, of a husband, wife, and children, or it could be in the context of you girls living together, whether it was one roommate or many. But honesty is God's way for a family of Christians to become a Christian family. And if you're doing this, then children will not be looking up to their parents in a false picture of the parents' goodness. And you girls living together won't be looking to any leader and searching and looking for a false picture of their goodness. You'll be looking to the Lord. And then you, as individuals in a family can help one another, because none of you are trying to take each other out. And then it's the key to fellowship. Spurgeon, of course, many years ago, said that fellowship, the definition for fellowship, which he used, was simply knowing and being known. Now, I think we call a lot of things fellowship today, which probably have nothing to do with fellowship. But fellowship is knowing and being known. And you know, when you can let down all the barriers of somebody and be yourself, oh, boy, what a relief. And that's the person you can really have fellowship with. Knowing and being known. And of course, it can be a very frightening as well as a releasing experience. Sam Shoemaker says that truth is the tonic of fellowship. It keeps it from becoming soft and squashy. We all have a general idea that fellowship is wonderful and we want it very much, but sometimes we're not willing to pay the cost for it. The cost is chiefly the willingness to go through the pains of giving and receiving the corrective of the truth. We put ourselves out of fellowship in two ways: by refusing to be honest with others when we see them doing a wrong thing or doing the right thing in a wrong way, and by refusing to receive from them the same tonic of honesty as to our own needs. We can be pretty sure that when someone is a good enough friend to say something candidly but lovingly critical to our face, the truth is probably more than what they say. Mere brutal frankness is only cruelty, but speaking the truth in love is an apostolic command, and it is much more. It is the only way of renewal and progress in human relations. No home is secure, no relationship is sound without the element of loving honesty. And of course, you have to be willing to take it as well as to give it. It can't be a one-way street. And then the fourth thing is that honesty is the key to personal effectiveness. Have you ever noticed that those of you who ever have gotten honest with someone that you perhaps were trying to help, when you shared your life with them, the failures, not just all your victories, that from that moment on, you were identified together in a much deeper way? My friend that I mentioned a while ago, Addie, that has meant so much to me, I can remember specifically when she became much more to me than just a friend and a counselor. And it was when I went to her with a problem over a fella. Addie's older than I am, and I thought, man, she's so spiritual, and she's had this lit for so long, you know. And so I shared this problem, man. I was really eating my lunch, you know, and I was thinking about him all the time and having a real battle. So I finally screwed up my courage to go and tell her, and I just knew she was going to say, boy, listen, you're going to walk with Christ. You better get this thing settled right now, you know, no fooling around. And, you know, she didn't say that at all. She said, well, you know, kind of welcome to the human race. It never gets any better. And, you know, I thought, gosh, big spiritual giant Addie still has problems over salad. And you know, that just made her so precious to my heart, and then I felt I could share anything with her. She went on to explain that, you know, just thinking about a guy went wrong, it was where he stood. Does he stand between you and the Lord, or does he force you to the Lord? Which is very helpful. But you know, that endeared her to my heart, and we were buddies, just to know that my big spiritual giant, my jolly spiritual green giant, had clay feet just like I did. She still had a heart. And you know, this meant so much. Bruce Larson, the man who wrote this book I referred to, Dare to Live Now, asked us over a period of time many people to answer two questions. He asked them to tell him, to think seriously, and tell him, what single person had the greatest influence in your life through the years? Second question was to tell him the nature of the relationship that they had with this person. And he said it was very interesting that certain things came out each time, or one or two things came out, they formed a pattern. And these are the things that came out. It was someone who identified with them, someone who listened to them, didn't just talk all the time, but listened. Someone who was vulnerable, who opened themselves to the person and trusted them. You know, when you're honest and open yourself to someone, it has to be someone you trust. Someone who's vulnerable. Someone who had a willingness to receive, you know, who wasn't just the big giant always giving, but who was willing to receive from you. And then the other thing was honesty, personal honesty. And I thought that was quite interesting. Personal honesty. Okay, and then the areas of dishonesty. What areas, or really with what people, I guess I mean, are we dishonest? I think the first one, of course, is God. Are you really honest with God in prayer? Well, when I think back and think how many times I've tried to feed God the same line I feed everybody else, and He knows me all the time. He knows me better than I do and better than anybody else does. But it's a temptation to talk to God like we talk to others, only when we're pretending to talk to Him in public, you know. When you pray in public, do you really talk to God? Boy, it's hard not to play it for the audience that's there, isn't it? It's hard just to play it to God. And I think we are dishonest in our prayer, and then I think we're often dishonest in our witness before other people. Jesus had a word about this, you know, when He talked to the scribes and Pharisees, who were, of course, the super, super religious people of His day. And in Matthew 15, I'm reading from Living New Testament, starting with verse 7 through 9, and then reading verses 25 through 28. He said, "You hypocrites, well did Isaiah prophesy of you. These people say they honor me, but their hearts are far away. Their worship is worthless, for they teach their man-made laws instead of those from God." Another translation says, their worship of me is merely the memorized injunctions of men. And he said, you know, they say they love me, honor me, worship me, but he said, boy, their hearts aren't there. Their hearts are far away. And if we listen to just the testimonies we give in church sometimes, it sounds pretty good, doesn't it? But God knows your motive. 25 through 28 says, that's the wrong reference. Must be a different chapter. Sorry. Scratch that one. And then we're dishonest with ourselves. We not only try and fool God, but we try and fool ourselves. We don't want to look at ourselves objectively. We've taken years to develop a very subjective viewpoint. We've formed a very beautiful image of ourselves, and we think we're pretty nice people. There isn't really anything bad about us. We're pleasant and friendly, likable, and actually people would admire us a lot more if they just got to know how nice we were. And this is the kind of image we build up about ourselves. And we project it as best we can onto everybody we meet, especially those that we want to impress. And in fact, we don't take much time with those we don't think can further our cause. We know how to say all the right words and how to make them feel good, you know, how to direct the conversation. But all of it, we're carefully calculating to make us look good in their eyes. And we just don't waste much time on those that can't be of benefit to us. And so we are dishonest with ourselves. and then we're dishonest in our family or, in your case, perhaps living situation, those that we live closest with. And oftentimes, this is where it's hardest to be real. And often, too, it's where our mask falls the most, but we blame it on everything else. You know, I've got a terrific headache tonight, and, you know, I really didn't mean to say that, but it's just that I've had this headache all day, or it's just this or it's that. And we try and blame it on anything else except ourselves. Children make a terrific scapegoat for those of you who aren't married yet. You know, you can always blame things on them. Sandra and I were talking before the message tonight, and I was telling her that I was having a bit of a problem trying to get this typed with children, and she said that she finds when she's typing something that she's trying to be very accurate about, like a thesis, and Brent comes up, if she makes a mistake, she blames it on Brent, you see. And, you know, it's easy to blame them. They're tremendous scapegoats. You can blame them for all sorts of things. But, you know, God still knows that it's your old, dirty, rotten heart and attitude. And then, friends, we try and fake out our friends, and lastly, we try and fake out even strangers. And sometimes we try most to impress them because we know they have no way of finding out about us. And then the final point is the cost of dishonesty. The first cost, I think, is in mental and emotional illness. And so much of our mental and emotional illness today comes from this failure to be honest. And you cannot blame particularly the person involved. You have no reason to sit in judgment and say, well, boy, that's their problem. If they just didn't, you know, if they carried the mask and weren't honest. Do you know who makes others carry the mask? We do. We require of our Christian friends a standard which God does not require them. And when a Christian comes into our fellowship, a new Christian, he looks at us and says, well, this is the way you do it. And so they try and perform like we're performing, and of course we're faking it. And so we are the ones that cause others, if not ourselves, to have these mental and emotional illnesses. The hardest thing we want to do is admit our mistakes. And many of psychiatric work, again, quoting from Bruce Larson, he says, many in psychiatric work maintain that emotional and mental illness is often caused by our insistence that we are right. Those who have admitted some error of long-standing move toward maturity and toward healing. But isn't it hard to admit that we're wrong? And this is what causes so much of the mental illness. Another psychiatrist says that emotional illness does not result in a barrier between the conscious and the unconscious in a person, which so many have said, but rather emotional illness results from a barrier between the conscious self and other people. The wall we build up. It's our inability to love and be loved and to have friends and to be a friend in any depth that causes much of our contemporary illness. When honesty and sharing of life begins, healing often begins. Someone has Proverbs 14:30 in the Amplified. Okay, a calm and undisturbed mind and heart are the life and health of the body, but envy, jealousy, and wrath are as rottenness of the bone. How many of you, you don't have to show your hands, but how many of us admit when we are filled with envy, jealousy, wrath? Well, it's not Christian to admit that, is it? We wouldn't be good Christians if we said we were really just jealous to the core of something someone had, or envious of their boyfriend, or, you know. So we smile and wear the mask. And God says all that's going to get you is rottenness inside, emotionally and mentally. spiritually. So it causes mental and emotional illness. It creates separation, isolation. I'm sure there's some in this room, even in a group of this size, who, though smiling and active in a group, feel very, very much alone, very isolated from others. And I lived with a girl once who oftentimes would go through emotional traumas and would isolate herself from us. And finally, you know, we would, in a manner of speaking, get bloodied and beaten in trying to knock the door and the walls down to get to her. But when we did, she was crumbling and crying out for this love and acceptance. She didn't want to be isolated. You know, it's not very many who want to take the time to be battered and beaten to get to past the isolation. And oftentimes it's being dishonest that isolates us and separates us from one another. And then it causes death. That can be spiritual, emotional, mental, but a separation, a death, like in the case of Ananias and Sapphira. Of course, theirs was a physical death. But being dishonest causes a death in some area of our life because it separates us from others. And then it causes a loss of fellowship with God and with man. I won't take time to read it, but this little book, Continual Revival, by Norman Grubb, has a good word on this about, it's like we're living in a house with the roof on and the walls up. And when we come to Christ, it's like taking the roof off and opening ourselves to Him. And you know, in even coming to Christ, we have to admit we're wrong. And this takes the roof off and we're open with God. But in order to be truly open with God, the vertical relationship, the roof, we have to have the walls down too. We have to be honest with one another. And so in order for to have fellowship with God, we also have to maintain a right fellowship with our fellow man. And the last thing is the discovery of being found out. The cost of dishonesty is that we are often discovered and found out. We are exposed. And then the whole world knows that we aren't what we said we were. I'll give you two scriptures on that just in closing. Proverbs 12:19. Truth stands the test of time. Lies are soon exposed. And Proverbs 11:3. A good man is guided by his honesty, but the evil man is destroyed by his dishonesty. So I'll just challenge you tonight, if you feel like maybe you haven't grown as fast in your Christian life as you'd like to, or that you don't seem to think it's as real as you thought it would be, or if you've been horribly disappointed in the training program because it hasn't met all your needs, or, you know, whatever God is speaking to you about tonight, you might just sit alone and say, God, is it because I'm a phony? Is it because I'm dishonest? Is it because I don't want anybody to see me like I really am? And then be willing to pay the cost of whatever He says to you. Shall we pray? Father, I pray that this is not an intellectual exercise tonight, but I pray that You would speak deeply to each of us about this matter and about what You want us to learn from it. And Father, whatever You're putting Your finger on, I just ask in my own life, and I trust I can say this for the girls, please don't stop till You've gotten through to me on anything that needs yet to be set straight in this matter, Lord. And whenever I attempt to lift the heavy mask again and pretend, please help me, God, to know it and not to do it. To be willing, to be transparent, to be real with You, with others. To be honest in my relationship with You and with others, and in my fellowship with You and others. And I pray this for the girls. In Christ's name.